Mr. Warner, Reel 10. You were, as I say, with B Echelon for about a month, and after Christmas, the battalion had moved on to another hill, which was Point 210. Were they there, do you recall, at that time? Because following that, they went to Camp Casey. I don't know if you remember Camp Casey.
No, we went. Didn't we go to 355 after Christmas?
After Casey.
We were only at 355 twice.
Ah, right. Well, if you run twice, it must have been before Christmas, because I know you were definitely on 355 after Camp Casey.
After Christmas, we'd gone on to 355 because the position, at least the hutchie we had, was at the bottom of the hill. It was up a little rise, and it was stuck up on its own, and there was three of us in it, Johnny Kenny, Harry White, and myself. And the canteen was away across here, the cookhouse rather, and when you came out there, like a little flat green, to a little, maybe a knoll or two to sit on to have your meal. And away to the right, it was the B's, it was the American position we took over from. We took over from these Americans. And this is the annoying part about it, about the cheapness of the British Army, or the British Armed Forces, whatever they call it, that we went to DC, the BHQ, which was just along in a long line, really, in the road running in front of it. And we went in there, and now our electricity system consisted of 1224 volt car batteries, double filament, which you cut a bit of cable, about 6 inches of cable, bare the ends, and soldered under these cardboards. And then you stripped it and bare the cable here. And we ran a cable round the room, and you fastened these onto it and taped them all up. Three of you doing all this business. And then we went outside, and we had a bank of batteries, maybe six batteries all connected up, or a charging engine. And that was our lighting system. When we went into that hutchie, the Americans were taking theirs down, which was one cable with bulb holders with 150-watt bulbs in and a 4-kilowatt charging engine in a trailer outside. And their lighting system went like that, and it run all day, and you just had to keep it filled up with diesel. We got one of those in the last month when it was all over. We got one of those, and it was brilliant. But that was what we had to do. When you moved into a new position, you had to go and do all this for our electric supply with batteries that are thin and soldering these wires on. And if the one blew, you had to go and untape it or take it off. You also be used to have a few spares ready, because you knew if it did blow, you just had to take the tape off and put some new ones on. But that was 355 when we went the first time. Don't think it was as easy to get up onto it. You had to walk, and it was a 355, because you brought it, they called it. She was a high spot. But if I remember rightly, we were at the bottom of it. The BHQ was at the bottom of the hill, nearly on the level. Yes, it was, because the battery charging section here was piped, and then the BHQ was in the corner, and I think that. And up on the top, trying to think, it was up on the top. We saw Pioneers, I think, were on the top behind us. And then over the other side was a Canadian ammunition, or a Canadian would deliver an ammunition to it for somebody. It blew up eventually. I don't know why. Somebody did something wrong and it went up.
And this was a much more active hill at the
Where York. I would think it would be, yes. They would be probing, we'd have patrols out as well. And I think, apart from the early one in November that they had out, this would be where I don't like to say it really, because we still had to go out there and telephone lines, because I wasn't involved in the telephone lines, and I was on this doing the batteries then. I was the permanent their staff sort of thing with the batteries, which is Johnny Kenny.
And that was your sole task, looking after those batteries?
That was my job, yes. From more or less turn Christmas, as they went back to Camp Casey, would be there for, I think they would pull us out in the end of January.
Can you, whilst you've mentioned it, can you describe Camp Casey and what it was like there?
Vast. Horrible. Old bulge.
Tents?
It was all tents, yes, it was all tents. Recreational purposes, it's very good. I could play football every day, and I like football. And we did play football every day. Recreation, and in the afternoon, we were finished for this or an afternoon. On the morning, you had a bit of guard duty, a bit of parade duty, and a bit of drill, that sort of thing. So I think then there would be swimming involved. You could go swimming to the gym, you say. More recreational time altogether. You still had a little bit of boulder dough, you know, paper stones and things, and they had guard duty to do as well. But it was a big rest area. It was massive. When I look at pictures now, you know, and say that, well, it was as big as that.
Was it a pleasant time there? I mean, you've described the score and so forth.
I think it was a boring time, really, because there was that many, I think the battalion was all there for a start, and you hadn't seen people, and you'd say, well, so-and-so, no, he's gone. He'd done his 6 months, and he's gone. And other lads were coming in, you know, the lads you went to school with, and you, I've got a cousin who said, oh, you've 2 doors off me, you know, that sort of thing. You meet people that came from your own area.
This was national service, because when your time was up, they went and new ones came in.
Yes, but I think some of them had volunteered from Berlin, you know, signed on for another 6 months or something like that. So from June or July, they'd done the 6 months, and then they were on the way home. But Camp Casey, I didn't care for Camp Casey at all. No.
Was it dirty? Was it muddy soil ground? You know, there wasn't,
no, it
wasn't
soil, yes. We had one or two changeovers as well, and, you know, the Brigadier would go, so they would have a parade for the Brigadier, and then it would be, I think, Anzac Day, April 25th, isn't it? That's Anzac Day. So they would have a parade for them, and they nearly always shows the buglers of the different night infantry. Because they didn't have buglers, did they, all the other young set? But they were really good, our buglers. They were really good. They were always in demand somewhere for welcoming somebody or saying goodbye to somebody. I mean, we lost a brigadier daily went. And then we lost the divisional commander when he got changed over. So they would have the parade for him, you see. So there was always some sort of red tape to, you know, you're on parade tomorrow, you know, number one dress sort of thing, make sure everything's clean. And I mean, you used to wear all the olive greens and it's non-blanco, so it was handy gear. Very, very good there. I don't know how designed it, but it was lovely. You didn't have to polish any brasses off. You just hooked them in. And you were kitted up in no time, minutes, and your body beer was on.
At what point in time did you get a leave? Did you go to Japan for a leave?
I went to Japan for a leave, yes, somewhere around about April, I think, maybe the early part. 5 days, Ebisu holiday camp. And the first thing you went when you got there, you took your olive greens off and discarded them, and you had a shower. And they had a lovely restaurant there. You had Canadians. It wasn't for Americans, it just was for Commonwealth there. There was Australians and Maoris, and they didn't like each other, the New Zealanders and the Australians. They didn't like each other at all, and they were always fighting, you know, even in the restaurant, you know, in the restaurant. Because, I mean, I was only small. These lads are all 6 foot, and they're all like that. And I mean, the New Zealanders weren't there, but all the Australians seemed to be like, and all the Maoris, like, which were transported, they all seemed to be big lads, and they didn't like each other at all. And you used to go out and hammer and tell them, say, well, get back there, Johnny, you were all right, put outside, go outside the window, you know, and they used to really lace into each other. But, you know, when you're with them, they were great people. I like the Australians, I had some nice times with them there.
And what kind of activities then did you do whilst you were on leave?
We were just sightseeing. We had tours on for you, you see. We went to one which was like an agricultural place where they were injecting vegetables with the needle, you know, and you get parsnips up here, and turnips and carrots. This is the impression. I'm thinking on great big cabbages, and they're all fed chemically. I don't know whether you eat them, but and the Ginza, the shopping place, which was a great big store, you know, and you look at it and say, God, many Woolworths could he get in there?
Was this in Tokyo?
This
is in Tokyo.
Yes, it's Tokyo, yes. No, they had their trips on. You could go to different functions. No, I remember they built a cinema in a day outside their miso camp for you to go and watch this Japanese, I think it was a Japanese film really that you went to see. But to see, they just came with the wagon and the like 8x4 sheets, and they just stuck them all together. They all seemed to fit together, and in a day it was built, and you went on the night and you saw this film, this Japanese film. Or was it an American film with Japanese subtitles? I can never remember now. But it didn't last very long.
Drinking places, obviously.
There was a bar just outside there, yes, just a bar. You could get a... they had the WVS, you know, they had a library in there as well, and a restaurant. You could go and... they had all these paper supplies as well, like I said before, the American News and the Crown News were there, and you could get papers from England, might be a few days old, like, but you could always get papers to read and books, and the WVS were there, and then I'm sure it's a good chain, they had a place in there as well, and you could, again, I think you could buy... If you wanted to send anything home, you say, you could send from there. That was done for you. Just went and gave me the name address, paid your money, and they sent everything for there.
And had your pay accumulated with being in the front, and so to, and so you had plenty of money with you? I mean, how did
no money. I think I had £30, which I had saved in credits. And that's about all I had. And it was an annoying source because the Australians were on £2 a day. We only got £2 a week. I don't know how you would describe it, but for the first 3 months in Korea, you qualified for £12. And for every month after that, you got £1 for the chance of them blowing your head off. And now, when I came out, I think I qualified for about the £21. That's what I got.
That's on top of your normal pay, was it?
That was £21 I got paid after I'd done a year in Korea. I think the first 3 months you got £12, and for every additional month after that you got another £1. So I got £21 for my time in Korea, for a year in Korea, for them to chance to blow my head off, and I wouldn't put a qualifier. You know, depending on when you did it, I would get £12 plus whatever it was.
But so the British were the worst paid of the Commonwealth troops.
I mean, we have... They give you uniforms of a sports coat and flannels. They're neither one thing or another. And when you see these other units, we're cheap. It's still cheap now with them. You know, I don't understand it at all. It ends up with blood and guts that does it. Now, you know, you can't take any pride in the uniform, but they were terrible.
What were the Japanese like? Was it to be first contact with Japanese?
I don't know that we did much. The only contact they had was the waitresses, that when you came for your meals, and they used to talk in high voices and very quick, so it didn't make any difference, really. And that's the only contact you had with the Japanese, apart from if you stayed out after midnight at the military police caught you and give you the good thumping with their big sticks and chuck you in their jail, which happened to one lad out of our platoon. He stopped out at about 12:15. He said, I was trying to get back in the jail court, and he said, I'm just wondering, he didn't say anything. He never said anything, he just hit us with his stick, and the next thing I'm in the lockup.
This is the Japanese military?
Japanese police, yes, they did the curfew. There must be four of them in the jail.
There must have been camp followers. I mean, lot of money, lot of troops.
Well, I don't know that. Well, there always is that, isn't there? But from my point of view, we didn't have any money. What were you going to? You know, their prices were way out of what. When the Australians were on top, you had the Americans there, which had everything. They had all the money. They had all the good uniforms. No, that you just did your own little simple thing, really, in the camp, and then you went to the bar. I mean, I didn't drink. You used to just go and sit and have half a beer, and lasted all night and listen to everybody talk. No, it was, I don't think I drank much like him. I'd just have a beer before we left there, but not a lot.
How many days leave did you have in Japan?
Well, they called it five, but it was like a day when you went, you left the camp on, say, the Monday to go to Seoul, and you'd catch the airplane there, and it would take you to an airport somewhere near Tokyo, but it was a good ride in a wagon after that, or a bus, might have been a bus from there, a wagon, but you're always back on the Friday. So you would have about three good days in Tokyo, and then, when you first got there, you had to go and went and got showered and did out whatever you called a haircut and everything that you'd wanted to do. You know, if you wanted to stop in the bath for an hour and the water up your neck, you could do it. But if you wanted to stop under the shower with all the hot water, it was lovely. And you'd go through the screen or whatever you'd do with you, and you feel all right. And clean uniform, you could change your uniform every day if you wanted to, twice a day if you wanted to. But it used to be, that was really good. You couldn't get a change of clothes. You couldn't get civilian clothes, you had to wear mufti, just the same, like, or your olive greens and your army boots. You weren't allowed shoes, you had to wear army boots.
So you'd return then to 0.355, really, didn't you?
And I think then they'd gone back into the line then, because when we went back into the line, there was two different lads in the hutchie I was in with. You lost me before to describe it. This, the Royal Engineers had blown holes in 355 to make hutchies out of. And it was on a bit of a slope like that. And all he'd done, he'd blown the hole, and you had to have it up. And we had a long way down to dig it out, this blast tread. I mean, there must have been about 25 metres maybe to get the dig out to make the trench out and step it down onto the road that came along that the engineers had put in. But it was about 6 foot six by barely 6 foot. There was two bunks there and there was one there. And the hobo Haley, I've never known anybody sleep. He could sleep 24 hours a day. And Fred from Hetman White. But he liked his kip, he did. But everything, your webbing and everything was hung around the walls. Everything was to hand. And I think we'd have a grain gun in the boxes as well. And then, and we had a 2-inch mortar as well and two boxes of bombs. That was part of the defence system for the battle. We had it in the battery charging section. That was our commitment. So when you stood two on a night, you had to take this all this with you. Oh, it used to be really, you know, nobody ever thought about saying, well, we'll get a pair of wheels from somewhere so we can wheel it up there. But that one, we had that as well, a Ben gun and two boxes of magazines and a 2-inch mortar and two racks of, I think one or six bombs, three bombs to each rack. But you were cramped in the place, you know, you were really, and you had, you couldn't put this heat, well, I was in April, didn't want the heating system in, we just had candles in it to see it around with. But, let's see what they do, that was a long ride in there, but it was really cramped in there. If you were the three of you, then, you know, you told you had to get into bed while the other one moved about to do what you had to do. But,
And the same heating system? Well, although no, you said you didn't have it, though, of course, that's right. You didn't have it,
there was no need for it. Luckily, in the way we were there, it was all rock, so we didn't have any trouble with water coming in. It had been, I don't know, it had been sailed over the top. I think it was just a hole blown into the rock. And, you know, they'd more or less made a little bit of jello, squared it up inside, so you could put the... I remember that the bunks were already in when I came back.
What were they made of, the bunks? How were they manufactured?
The beds were just, we just cut trees down, or any bit of wood you could make, and then it was a telephone wire wrapped round in a crossover. And as I mentioned before, one British regiment took over from the Dillons, complained, apart from taking the boxes, they even took the telephone wire as well. So when he went in, threw his bedroll onto the bed, it just went straight through, because there was no telephone wire. They took it all. Took everything with them. But that's what it was. If it broke, I mean, the same would turn up plenty of wire. But that was another interesting theme, because we had mentioned camp followers. There used to be some. You never saw them. I never saw them really, because I wouldn't trouble them out so much then. But if you had to go around a hill, you would be rolling the wire out in your position. Someone's vehicle is moved under this position maybe 3 fields away. Send them a landline out. So you would get them so far, they're walking around this hill. You get the big company in there, and they'll take a pat and you say, there, look. Well, it's funny, just lay it there, dead as a haddock. And then somebody would be there and say, if I said he goes, no, I bet that's where the air is gone. Where's it gone? The same reason you use it. He's moved in, and he's cut your wire for the bed, and that's what used to happen. You can go back around the hill and find where it's been cut. So, well, that's incredible, that. And he said, right up, go and see the corporal and get a couple of escort, a couple of riflemen or something, and he'll be looking. There it is there, and he'll give you all the paper. Come in, Johnny, now let's have a look in there. And he pulled the flap back, and he telephoned why somebody's there. He's making a bed for them. It's like a need, I suppose. You make the own men. I mean, we've got the wire, and they want some, we've got to cut a piece out, we've got plenty more, we've gone to the end of the line. But little incidents like that, I can remember those as well.
Did you recall the night that the Chinese put their attack in on 355 and fell on basically on D Company? It's been
little. It was all the sound, too, there'd be plenty of flares flying about and plenty of artillery. But I don't remember much about it. But you see, as I said, when he got to that part, we were doing 24 hours, I might have had my head down. I might have done a duty that night, or if you're doing it, you don't have time to be going on the hill and saying, there's Charlie up there, you're too busy looking after your batteries and your charging engine, because you used to have maybe 4 or 5 of them going, so you were checking them all the time. If one stopped, you had to quickly get it over there, because once the engine stopped, the lights went down. So you had the batteries never as a standby to change over, fill it up with petrol, check the oil, fire it up again, get it over, and you were like going round that all the time, you see. Apart from the sergeant major, maybe he's keeping an eye on you as well, you see. Saying that you've got an idle bomb, just do this or just do that, you see.
Who was the sergeant major, by the way, the signal sergeant?
The signal sergeant, Sergeant Mason. He lives at Stanley, comes to the meeting, and Sergeant Spires from Hull. Captain Tomlinson. Yeah, we only had 2 signal sergeants and half a dozen corporals. The lance corporals. They're all in the book here.
Any more memories of .355?
Well, apart from meeting the lad who's now the secretary of the Durham Cleveland branch of the Korean veterans, Alan Maggs, he came there. So we were in a hutching 2 or 3 times, really, together. He was in my hutchie there, but he was an operator. He went as a CO's operator eventually. He was a smart lad. He used to be a projectionist at the Odeon at Bishop Auckland, that he could do wonders with radios and headsets and that. And at that time, I think we got some Japanese radios, Zeniths, they were going to be saved from all over the world, but you had to have a battery for it. So you had to be nice to the people on the battery section to make sure that the sergeant's best or the corporal's best could get a battery, you see, to work these radios. And I know we had a one, or we had a connection to it, and this Alan Maggs, who was in this, I don't know if it was 355 or not, it might have been later. It might have been in the reserve position. Do you want to still stop with 355?
Well, basically now we're down to what memories you have that we haven't covered.
Yes, well, not much with the second time on 355, apart from, it's possibly that night, I do remember you about the attack. I know there was an awful lot of shelling, and I was in the exchange, and the signal sergeant came in, and because I was on the battery section, he said to these 2 lads, you've got the go out with the lines out at so and so, and this lad said, oh, I'm not going out there. Not while you're doing that. And he said, well, you'll have to go. I said, well, all right, we'll go. But what they'd done is they'd come to where they'd had a culvert in the road, and they'd stopped under there till the shelling had eased off, and then they'd gone on to lay the line. But he said, no way am I going out in that.
Could you, as National Serviceman, did you have that kind of relationship? If you got an order you didn't like, you expressed disapproval immediately?
Well, no, you were frightened to death, weren't you? You were thinking, right, you were putting the guard on. But some of the people that came were very rebellious. These weren't two lads out in Durham, these were two lads out, and one was out of Hereford, and one was out of Shropshire, out of Broadley. And one of them, well, I said he was wild. He was a real, he only was 18 years old, but really was a wild, he's different now, but he was a really wild youth then. He had I don't know whether you would call it a cruel streak in him, but I remember somebody saying to him, how many frogs can you get on a, you know, send me frog out these frogs groping away, how many frogs can you get on a 18 inch bayonet? And he would say, about 60. You can't. You come with me, I'll show you. And he would find a trench where all these frogs were, and he would be going, right, one, two, and he would get to the hilt with about 15. And he would say, 16, and this one would split and fall off. And he would do that today, 60. And all these split frogs are laid off. But this, I mean, the snake bit him, and I think it's a snake that died, not him. He didn't take any effect at all. But he seemed such a wild lad. You know, he was always rebellious. Ben wasn't too rebellious. There was a corporal who was a professional boxer. And he didn't bother me. I just accepted these people. But we had some Cornish lads outside. Get you caught a professional boxer or no professional boxer? Outside. But, no, there was. They were a cross match of people.
Do you remember the names of these people you've mentioned?
I remember all of them. Bob Cann, Huey Jory. They were all they didn't want to be with the Durhams, they were all Cornish lads, they wanted to be with the Joker Cornish because they were in a nice post in Belize somewhere, I think, where it was warm.
So you had a number of men who'd come from, in effect, the regiments.
We had a lot of people. They had drafts that had gone to different light infantry main places, trained Taunton, Bodmin, Borden. The Coyley place, Bundy Wakefield, Shrewsbury, and then they'd done the 6 weeks basic there, then they'd gone to Strensford for a further so many weeks training, and then they just came along one day and said, right, well, that's it, you're half a going to the Durham's in Korea, and you're half a going to the Somerset in Malay, and that's what he did. And that's how you got a mismatch of, yeah, you have them from all over, and I often ask them when I see them on these different things, how did you get in the Durham's? Don't know. We just got sent here, then they picked the draft from here, sent us to Stencil. The man come round one day and said, all you on the right go to Korea, and all you on the left go to Korea, and that was it.
Most of them accepted it, didn't they, I suppose, in the end.
Yeah, there was nothing else. The annoying part about it was when we came here to Durham, if they wanted to go home, it was an 18-hour train journey for them. So in the end, a lot of them, I mean, I had a lad came from Lindemere, stayed with me at West Auckland, because it was such an odd place to get to.